Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Democracy Nerd. Over the past few months, it is not hard to think that something is wrong with our system of government. We want to call it a democracy. The discussion today is, how might we get there? How might we make it a democracy? From riots at the U.S. Capitol to state bills attacking voting rights and voter access, it is hard to think that everything in democracy is working well, but maybe that is a moment that will galvanize us to recommit to democracy. It's enough to make one wish for a handy guide to help us fix democracy in the United States. And just our luck, today we're joined by that handy guidebook's author, Kristen Eberhard, Director of Climate and Democracy at the Sightline Institute of Think Tank, the Northwest, author of Becoming a Democracy, How We Can Fix the Electoral College, Gerrymandering, she might say gerrymandering, and our elections. Welcome our friend, Kristen Eberhard. How are you doing, Kristen?
Thank you. I'm doing great.
Let's start with that. What is your preferred pronunciation for gerrymandering or gerrymandering?
I say gerrymandering. It was from Eldridge Gerry, but I go with the popular pronunciation, which is gerrymandering.
I remain unpopular. The title of the book, Becoming a Democracy, sort of suggests, maybe more than suggests, more than implies, the United States is not one. Make that case.
Democracy means that the power comes from the people as a whole. And that was, revolutionary, literally came from the American Revolution at the time, the idea that it didn't come from God or from, a bloodline or kings, but that the people should be in charge. And so on the one hand, we made this great step forward in the United States when we created democracy. On the other hand, we have always from the beginning not actually wanted to include all people. So the very beginning, we only included less than 10% of people were even allowed to vote. We now have, technically all adults are allowed to vote, but we still actually, in effect, exclude a lot of people from participation.
All right. Do you agree with the Princeton Northwestern study, overly simplistic conclusion is that we are better defined as an oligarchical plutocracy than democracy?
So I have seen, I love that study, but I've also seen some critiques of that study, so I don't want to endorse it too wholeheartedly.
A couple critiques and it scares you away?
I know,
a couple
right?
Critiques, that's all it takes. It's always critiques.
What? There's supposed to be evidence?
Was there any oligarchs funded the critiques?
Yeah. But the overall idea that wealthier, more privileged people have more power, I think is pretty, I will not dispute that thesis.
Well, it seems unassailable.
Unassailable.
Is there anybody, is there any critique of that? It seems like the debate right now is either that's true or let's not talk about it or that's good. It seems like those are the responses. Is there anybody who has a fourth argument of no, that's not true and things are going great and the people are in charge?
I don't think so. Yeah, there's a Republican quote recently that said, well, you can't just think about the quantity of votes. You have to think about the quality. we don't just want everybody voting. What are your qualifications as an oligarch if you're going to show up and vote?
That'll get to it because I'm going to talk about your various pillars. I'm also going to want to talk about sortition. That's a teaser. It's a teaser.
Sortition.
I know. It's a teaser. So you argue that, or I don't think you argue this. Some argue that the idea that we're supposed to be a democracy is socialist propaganda. And in fact, there are those now who are even undercutting because they sort of see maybe the writing on the wall, the people in charge, maybe some things will change. And that there is a significant differentiation between republic and democracy. How do you respond to that argument? Where do you line up on it? Or, I think I'm formulating a view at this point, but I'm more interested in yours.
If you really want to get technical, we are a democratic republic. So a democracy just means that the power comes from the people, and a republic means that you have a constitution, basically, that sets out the rules of the game. So we are a democratic republic. We say that it is the people ultimately, who get to vote and who get to decide, and the representatives are accountable to them. And we are a republic because we have a constitution and a system of representation.
All right.
So I completely agree with those people.
And you, no. But you roughly endorse... You roughly are in favor of a democratic republic.
Except for sortition. Yes. I'm in favor of a democratic republic that makes heavy use of sortition for representation.
Well, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that. Let's start, though, with another fake thing. Let's imagine... Let's imagine that you were to get the Infinity Gauntlet. I've heard the kids today, if we want to get the kids today caring about democracy, that we should make pop culture references. Okay. So let's say you had the Infinity Gauntlet and you were able to find all the Infinity Stones and you were going to be able to do a Thanos snap. But instead of trying to eliminate half of all human beings, which I do not think that would be your proposal, what would you do to become a democracy? And whether it's like one snap or maybe you get one for every jewel. What do you
think? Yeah, so I was like, how many words are in the snap? Is it like half of all people, like multi-member districts?
You can do your thing. You could say Kristen Ebert Hart democracy dream. And then that has 77 parts. You decide how long for which you want to hold forth.
Bam. Okay. So I would have a right to vote. So that, hey, everybody can vote. And then I would have a right to equal representation. So we wouldn't have crazy things like the Electoral College, which overrepresents some people. You know, some people are just more important in the Electoral College than others. And then I would basically get rid of gerrymandering by having multi-winner districts so that everybody gets a fair shot at representation. And then I would have sortition as a kind of a backstop to sort out the thorny problems that people who have to run for office can't solve.
So let's start with the first. That provides us a handy outline to go along with our discussion about your handy guidebook. How was it, by the way, writing the book? Did you enjoy it? Was it hard? Was it painful? I've heard people who have written books saying that finishing the damn thing is like defeating a monster.
Yeah, by the end, I'm like, I'm so tired of talking about the right to vote. But it also, you know,
I want to talk about Marvel superheroes. Yes,
right, exactly. I was like, I need to go watch a movie. But, you know, I finished the book mostly last spring, and then COVID hit right as we were sort of ramping up to publish. And so then I shifted gears and turned all my attention to helping other states vote by mail the way that Oregon does. And then I sort of came back to the book in the fall. So it was actually really nice to have that sort of time away and then come back and sort of put a few polishing touches on it and feel fond of it and not like it was a monster.
So I want to go through, I have some questions about it, but we'll order those questions almost like we're an extra long Blinkist, right? So people will be able to do some analysis of the book, but also catch up on the conversation a little bit. And what you said with your Thanos snap, I think you had four jewels in your snap. You started out, your first one was essentially freeing voters to vote. We know some of what's in their way right now. We know that it is a technique, might give it too much artistic credit, but it is now a technique by a major political party to limit those who vote, thinking that, you know, those people also might be some of the people who weren't in favor of an oligarchy or plutocracy. How do you characterize the unfreedom of voters to vote right now?
The unfreededom of...
Well, it's freedom. Maybe it's freedom. How free are voters to vote? What would you give us?
That really depends on the state, right? So in Oregon, we're doing pretty well. I mean, not perfect. There's a few more things we could do, but we're doing pretty well.
On the Kristen Ebert Hart scale, what would Oregon get? Scale 1 to 10?
I'd say an 8.
Nice. What would it take to get, what do we need to do to get to a 10?
So there's a few. So we don't pre-register 16-year-olds. We right now don't have a universal ballot tracking for our vote by mail ballots. We don't allow people who are in prison to vote. So, a few more things we could do.
Hear that, democracy advocates. You got some work to do in Oregon. What's a state that's doing real, real bad? Or, you know, I'm going to use that language. That's maybe below a 5 on your scale.
Yeah, Texas.
Ooh, Texas. All right. What would you give Texas?
I mean, okay. So if my scale is sort of like 1 is like you cannot vote at all, obviously Texas is not there. So maybe they're more like a 5.
All right. Well, no, I would think that 1 would not be like, you know, the Marcos fan, you know, doesn't have to be, you know, like, right. Like Stalin doesn't have to be a one, like Stalin can get to the negative.
Okay.
State,
okay,
you know
okay,
what I'm
okay.
saying? So it's like, we can still have like okay. in the main of the United States, right. Roughly speaking.
Oh, okay.
Is Texas the worst?
So then Texas is more like a two. Yeah. They're down there.
What would they need to do? How come they're a two?
So Texas does not automatically register their voters. They do not let anybody request to vote by mail. They do not allow drop boxes for their vote by mail ballots. They have attempted to make it a felony if you, or, you know, a crime if you make a mistake on your registration form, which kind of makes you just not want to do it. So they have lots of, they are sending lots of signals to voters that it is, they would kind of prefer that you not vote.
Are there, one of my great sadnesses is that the partisan divide around democracy itself has become pronounced. And it really is among my not very many greatest sadnesses that starting off a bed of agreement on fundamental structure seems important and useful. And it seems like we cannot have that assumption. Part of the reason this court sits is to think about how we might reform or create such, if not consensus, at least, you know, 65%, 70% agreement. Are there any Republicans you're looking to? And I'll give even more preamble. Back in the day, we would find, like, you know, there'd be a Republican Secretary of State in some state who would like be down, right? Like actually care about democracy, want to work on stuff. Is it just my jaundiced eye that is seeing that as less easy now that somebody, you know, we're seeing now the Georgia Secretary of State who said, well, my job is sort of democracy, and now they want to oust that person in the primary. Talk to us about what's happening with this partisan divide. Push back on my premise or help us understand it.
After the election, I had this moment of sort of naive hope that perhaps the election would change that, because there has been a growing consensus amongst both Democrats and Republicans that more people voting is good for the Democratic Party and bad for the Republican Party. And I question that assumption. And I thought that this election, with record turnout for both parties, it seems clear to me that there were new voters coming who were Republican voter. I mean, that's not just clear to me. That is clear from the data that not all the new voters in this election were Democrats. They were Republicans too. And yeah. I thought maybe that would shift the conversation, that maybe both sides would start to question this assumption that voters are good for Democrats, and that the Republicans would look around and say, you know what? We got some new voters and they voted for us. Maybe we should do more of that. I am disappointed to say I haven't seen that playing out in
why do you think, because, and why do you think that is? And I'll give some preamble here. One could imagine, let's imagine the post-mortem, every sort of political party after, and it's not just the party, right? But there's sort of a series of post-mortem meetings with some of the important strategists and funders and elected officials after wins and losses. What do we do well? What do we do differently? And one could imagine the Republican post-mortem being something like, you know, we were closer than anybody thought we might be. We got within, you know, not very many points. What do we need to be a majority party in the country? And then you can imagine somebody else in the room saying, no. It's not, the way we become a majority party is to make sure you don't have to be a majority party. That by making sure the Senate stays the way it is, the electoral college stays the way it is, that we, you know, keep down voting, particularly within urban areas, particularly in Black communities and with young people, that then we don't have to be a majority party in the way that most people would define that term. Why do you, I have my own answer to that. Well, I have my own hunch about this. Why do you think the side saying, no, don't work on the platform to get to 51% support among everybody, instead work the system so that doesn't matter as much? Why do you think that side wins?
So I see two big factors here. One is that the Republican Party did that postmortem after Mitt Romney lost in 2012, and they literally wrote the postmortem that said, we need to become a majority party. And to do that, we need to start reaching out, particularly to Hispanic voters. Hispanic voters are often a good match for us culturally. They are often pro-life. They are often you know, conservative in terms of their family values, and we have not been reaching them. And so the future of the Republican Party is to reach those socially conservative Hispanic voters and make them Republican voters. And so some people in the party started doing that. But what happened in 2016 was that that part of the party lost control of the nomination process. And instead of nominating Jeb Bush, who was, you know, out speaking in Spanish to supporters, or Marco Rubio, who is Hispanic, they, you know,
build a wall.
The voters nominated Donald Trump. And which brings me to my second hunch, which is that we have strong partisanship and weak parties right now. If we had a stronger Republican Party, I think that maybe there would be a different conversation, but it was a weak party. Trump took it over, took it apart, and left it kind of in disarray, where there's just not a strong enough voice to do that postmortem and say, what should we be doing as a party? Instead, everybody's kind of just chasing their tail, trying to be the next Trump.
I have heard you offer that insight before, and I want to give it blinking lights because it seems so important, necessary, and useful to understanding what's happening in American democracy now. I heard you say strong partisanship, weak parties. So whereas the old thesis was the party decides, right? And whatever sort of the collection of party elites, that filter, they'll keep out, let's say, Donald Trump from getting the nomination, right? Yeah. But partisanship, not necessarily in terms of, not necessarily always on policy, but in terms of identity, in terms of my team is great, your team is evil. Certainly on the Fox News watching side, never seen anything like it. I already teased part of my answer, which is, I think all of this is always a racial story. I think all of this stuff is always a media story, right? Like I think the Republican Party decided to be, maybe not the party, but the partisanship decided to be a white party. That to me is inextricably linked to Rupert Murdoch and Barry Diller pitching the idea to Rupert Murdoch, saying you could make a white Christian conservative, less urban news network, and you wouldn't need a majority of watchers to be the number one cable news network in the world. And then lots of websites started copying that model. And by the way, prior to that, Rush Limbaugh demonstrated the same thing on radio, which helped birth all this stuff. So that's my explanation. How do you think about, what do you see as the root of that divide between greater partisanship but weaker parties?
So I think some of it is structural, right? So we have a two-party system by design, because we use single winner districts, we are always going to end up with two dominant parties. But then we've done these reforms to try and give voters more power. So we created primaries to try and say, oh, we don't want, you know, people in smoke-filled rooms making these decisions. We want voters to be able to. But then that had these unintended consequences, that the most extreme voters in that party participate in the primary. And now they have this power to pick the candidate, even if maybe the party, you know, the powers that be would have chosen a more moderate, you know, person who could be more likely to have more appeal and win a general election. And so that combination of having only two parties, so there's just not that many options that voters have, and then we've given a lot of power to the most extreme faction within that party, has driven, in particular, the Republican Party to move into this. You know, what on the national scale puts the Republican Party is a kind of a fringe right-wing party. It is not a centrist right-wing party like Germany has or France has.
I have another hypothesis. I want to challenge your thought and then let you tell me where I'm wrong and stupid. And your thought reflects, I think, the collective wisdom of the intelligentsia, right? That there's sort of the smart Republican elites. They didn't want Trump, but Trump won anyway. And that's why there's now this push for anti-majoritarianness. I want to say maybe there's a different route. An additional and important and distinct route. That in fact, who has the motive to make sure that majoritarianness is less important? well, it seems like it's not necessarily a millions of voters. It seems like it might be the oligarchs themselves, right? That in fact, if I am funding this stuff, if I am funding Limbaugh from the beginning, if I'm buying Fox News early, if I'm running a big website, or let's say some hypothetical situation where I've applied the greatest amount of money in the history of humankind towards a political project. And to do that, I have built a network of think tanks like nobody's ever seen, and a network of communication apparatus that the world has never seen. And I might make sure that inserted in all of that stuff is an undercutting of the idea that we're smarter together than we are apart, that we're stronger together than we are apart, and make sure that, you know, the voices that say otherwise are wrong. That maybe it's not this idea of it's the dumb white working class voter that can't be trusted because they're racist and easy manipulated and they went for Trump. But in fact, that the thing has been rigged, not by that mythical or real human being, but by the also real sort of network of folks who are doing the manipulating. How do you reply to that?
Sure. I mean, yeah, the idea that the smart powers that be are more reasonable and moderate than Trump. I think that they didn't want Trump at the beginning, but once he won, they were like, okay, well, we can use him to get our tax cuts and our deregulation that we wanted anyway. So I don't think that they're out there trying to get rid of that situation. And yes, I think that, I think like especially what we see right now around voter fraud is that the news sources that people are getting, that Fox News viewers are getting, are telling them that there was rampant fraud in this election. And, and I sometimes think about what if the news sources that I trusted, that I thought this is a legitimate news source, look at it, it said, it's on cable news, it says fair and balanced, and it was telling me there was rampant fraud in this election. Yeah. Dead people were voting, people were voting twice. This election is not right. You can't trust this. I would be outraged. I would be in the street saying, like, how can this be happening in the United States of America that this election was so fraudulent, and why isn't somebody doing something about it?
That wasn't a Trump thing. Trump. Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Feel free.
No, so I just say that's a perfectly reasonable reaction to the information environment that you were in, and you are absolutely right. That information environment has been very knowingly and specifically created by the owners of those media outlets.
I mean, that was an ALEC thing, right? I mean, they've been pushing for a long time. And like the party elites that the much of the mainstream conversation has tried to shield from responsibility of the excesses of the current right-wing movement have been, in fact, at the root of the excesses of the right-wing movement. This is, to me, one of the, like I'll match you your sort of your party weak, partisanship strong sort of blinking light thing with another, which is Trump didn't start this stuff. We overrate his importance. We do not overrate his moral importance or his historic importance, but we overrate his original importance, his importance as a founder, originator, a thought leader in this stuff. Rather, he is more a retweeter than a think tank theologian. Mm-hmm. And anyway, I sort of want to flag that. And maybe this jumps ahead way too far. In the expanse of the Christian Eberhard brain, what do you think doing about that? Maybe it is as simple as go back to democracy, read my book. But how do we do that? If 46 to 54% of the people are going to care about democracy itself, how do we get to a place where we start actually doing it?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you present people with, when you ask people, do you care about democracy? Most people still do. But then when you present them with, hey, will you, go against your team, go against your side in order to promote democracy, that's a little harder question. And then when you say, hey, will you go against your team to do something that actually isn't going to help democracy, right? So will you vote against a Republican because they passed a bill in Georgia that they say, and your news sources say, is helping democracy by increasing election integrity? Then the answer is obviously, no, you're going to stick with your team. So my solution is there need to be more teams. I think that part of what makes it easy for, you know, the Rupert Murdochs or the Alex of the world to capture so much political power is that once you've gotten enough of this side, those people do not want to vote for a Democrat. And so you can push things pretty far and they're not going to defect because they don't have a good option to defect to. Whereas imagine if there were a socially conservative, but actually, you know, sane and moderate and pro-democracy party that some people could say, you know what, this is not sounding quite right. I'm not sure about this party. I'm going to go to the other one that matches my values, matches my identity, but also matches my belief in democracy.
All right. So you essentially say, let's mix it up. It used to be that parties were sort of mixed up and confusing, right? Like they were legitimately like strongly liberal, big R Republican elected officials, candidates, supporters, donors, et cetera, right? Yeah. Pretty much till Nixon and with a little bit of tail after that. There were legitimately rock ribbed conservative racist Democrats up until you tell me when.
Goldwater and the Southern Strategy.
There you go. So it's and so it was, we had sort of built in multi-party system, right? Yep. There were sort of multiple Democratic parties,
they were
sort of within their, you know, within a couple of banners. And now things, and I appreciate that. This is a basic, and I don't mean simple. I mean, essential, fundamental understanding. If we're going to do anything for us to have this shared understanding, that meant it was easier to find strange bedfellows because people were, you know, in all kinds of sorts of different beds. Also because it's related to another misunderstanding. I do think that liberal coastal elites are subject to some habits of mind that are wrong, stupid, destructive, and misleading. And some of that is this idea of the ex-urban rural voter as a dum-dum, under-informed, low-information voter. And that's the only reason they would disagree. Okay. And so, because of course, and I think part of it is because liberal elites define their self-image, identify their identity so much with their intelligence. And so if you criticize Bush, if you criticize Reagan, if you criticize Quayle, if you criticize Trump as a dum-dum, every liberal is like, yes, as a dum-dum. That's different from me because I'm a smarty pants, right? Chaplin did the same thing with Hitler. Didn't work so good. But then when you look at it, Trump voters were not under-informed. Like the Fox News voter, that they have some wrong information. They'll answer some tests in ways that are contrafactual, but they're not, in terms of amount of information, under-informed voters. So that I don't filibuster, feel free to push back on that or respond to it.
I completely agree about the information. I think that liberals do put a lot of emphasis. Like I often, when I talk about things related to democracy, people are like, we need more education. You know, that's what we need, is more education. And I feel like that's a knee-jerk reaction that it's not necessarily addressing the underlying problem. And I just want to go back to what you were saying about, to kind of emphasize, when we had this sort of mixed up party system, right, that we had two parties, but really within them were multiple parties. Part of what that did too, in the legislature, it meant there was more flexibility to work together because you did have these different views and you could work across party lines, just didn't mean as much. But for the voters, it also meant that you could have multiple identities that aligned in different ways, right? And so people they switched, they voted, they didn't vote straight ticket. They were sort of looking at like, who do I like? Who is saying things that I like? Not just like, what are they, a D or are they an R? And the realignment, one of the destructive things is that now the parties are so aligned with identities and it's hard. You're not going to go against your identity. You're not going to go against who you are. And so if who you are is a Democrat or who you are is a Republican, then you're going to vote straight ticket and you're going to be influenced by what, you know, if they say things that sort of didn't necessarily agree with your worldview, you might update your worldview to agree with them because they are representing your identity. And so a multi-party system where you have a few more options, now we might go back to a world, or, you know, not back, but forward to a world where you might have some cross-cutting identities. And so you might say, on this issue, I'm a Green Party, but on this issue, I'm a Democrat, or on this issue, I'm a Working Families Party. And that creates more flexibility both among voters and then among who they're electing to actually think about issues and get stuff done and not just think like, who am I? And the answer is Democrat or Republican.
Yeah, for the last, let's call it a couple election cycles, I've become more convinced that you're probably right. Right, that we need to shake it up so that we separate ourselves from being in a falsely binary world and thinking in terms of too simply friends and enemies with too many things lined up on either side. That said, let me push back against that a little bit, or at least, and I can do it in the form of a question. Europe still seems like they're getting messed up in places too. Places with parliamentary systems, like Israel doesn't seem like they're getting it all figured out. India doesn't seem like it's getting all figured it out. England doesn't feel like it's getting it all figured out. France, Italy, Greece. And you tell me, is there a democracy you think that's working really well that you can point to its party systems as a key reason?
First, parliamentary versus proportional. So parliamentary has to do with who's the head of government. So United Kingdom, Great Britain.
They usually walk together though, yes? I mean, there's some places that have presidential systems and proportional representation.
But for example, India and England are both parliamentary, but not proportional.
Yeah.
Second, multi-party system doesn't solve everything. It's not a silver bullet, but—
Is it even a bronze bullet?
Is it a bronze bullet?
What color, what metal of a bullet is it?
It's a bronze bullet.
Who's going to shoot at?
It's gonna kill anti-democracy sentiments.
Did you have proportional representation? So who's using proportional representation now?
So Germany, Sweden, Finland.
You started with Germany. Now, Germany seems to be doing all right. How long have they been doing proportional representation?
So they have been doing a form of proportional representation since before World War II, but they rewrote their constitution after World War II to revamp the type of proportional representation.
Oh, that's important, because the first thing I was going to do, you say Germany, is like, yeah, part of the concern of proportional representation is anything that moves away from majoritarian control, right? Puts a greater risk that a plurality can do the whole thing. And then somebody Trump, but somebody like Hitler, not the same thing, right? Can rise to power. In that constitutional change, what were the key changes? I don't know.
I just want to address that the idea that we are a majoritarian system, and so a plurality can't do something, and that proportional systems allow a plurality, that is actually completely untrue. So right now in the United States, we had a president who did not win majority support.
I concede that.
A Senate that does not have majority support. So we have a minoritarian system here, whereas proportional systems actually require a majority. Have to get a majority coalition together to get something passed.
All right. So I still want to get back to the Germany thing. Because again, I started with saying, I think you're probably right. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, me thinking that stuff is messed up is not the same as me thinking, and I'll say the Ben Cannon view, and it's as good a view as I've got. The Ben Cannon view is, listen, I'm for all this stuff because we just got to change things up. And it sounds simplistic, but it's at least as good as any analysis I have to offer for sure, to be very, very clear. There is a risk though, that just because stuff sucks now doesn't mean that the alternative to sucks less. So let's get back to Germany. What did Germany do to change the proportional system so that now you like it, whereas maybe the kind of system elected Hitler you liked less?
Yeah. So I'm actually not an expert on the Weimar Republic. I do know that in some sense, their proportional system did its job of keeping Hitler's party. They only won, they won plurality support. And so they only had plurality control of the government, which is why he manufactured a crisis in order to declare an emergency and basically seize authoritarian control. The system actually didn't give him that. He burned down the state house in order to get it. But other than that, I don't actually know a lot of details of it. But their current system that Germany uses is similar to the one that New Zealand uses very successfully. And it's kind of a hybrid system. So you still have some single winner districts like the United States, where you have, you know, your local rep, and then you have other representatives who are elected nationally, who are there to represent more of the national interest. And so you put those two things together and you get a more fair representation of people overall, and then people feel more trusting that the system is actually representing them and working for them.
Of the stones in your Thanos gauntlet, which is the most important?
I think this one is.
Okay. All right. I found our area of disagreement. And I do, I don't, and don't get me wrong. I tend to worship at the altar of Christian Eberhard, but the, or at least, you know, preach at the hymnal. that's not exactly right. So on a scale of 1 to 10 on how much it matters, what do you give it? It's like an 8, a 9, a 7. We could just set a baseline.
I'd say 7.
All right. So use New Zealand as an example. And I think a lot of democracy lovers are pretty big fans of New Zealand, right? They seem to like deal with their problem of mass murders, right? They seem to like actually be a social democracy that's kind of working. People seem kind of happy. They seem to have a leader that people are pretty psyched about. The analysis I saw had little to do with its voting system, had a lot to do with its media, that Rupert Murdoch had not taken hold. And that's where I would put number one, right? That's where I would put number one is that in any of these, you can break, right? A proportional representation, you can elect Hitler in a majoritarian system. Now, let's not call this majoritarian. How do you describe our current system?
I mean, technically it is called majoritarian, but that doesn't really work right now.
We need a word for the US system right now. If you don't like plutocracy, oligarchy, or majoritarian, we need a system. I don't want to just call it the US system.
Yeah.
All right, we need a word for that.
I have to come up
with
a word.
But that system can elect Donald Trump. And my point is not to just whack Trump, but to say that dude never got a majority of voters unless you believe in the like deepest, darkest recesses of 8chan. But it's helpful to know that you think that one matters most. What are the prospects right now? You're working to try to get towns like Portland to consider stuff like that. Is the next move trying to get cities to pilot it?
Yeah. Or school boards, I think, is a good place to pilot it. School boards are often, you know, especially in states with growing people of color populations like Oregon, the school boards are increasingly kind of out of step with the student population that they're serving. And they're also sort of an entryway, a place that a lot of people start getting engaged in governance. So I think those are a good place to try this out.
All right. So voter access, where do you put that? Where do you rank that on your infinity gauntlet stones? And what do you give it on a score 1 to 10?
Yeah. So voter access, I would actually put this lower just because there are a lot of places in the United States that are doing pretty well on this. The places that aren't are galling and horrific, but overall, it doesn't have as big as an impact, I think. So I would put it a little lower and I'd give it like a 5.
All right. So now I'm now realizing if we have multiple political parties, you and I are going to be in different political parties, which I really appreciate because we'll still agree on so very much.
Yeah.
And that'll help.
We could
still pass legislation.
We have a different label. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Because I would probably put this second, right? And it would sometimes contend with first. So the reason you put it lower is because there are more places doing well, so less energy needs to be put there, or because when you look at places that have strong voter access and places that don't, you just don't see a particular delta in performance of their democracies.
Yeah, I think the difference between states that have great voter access and the states that have, like, for example, actually New York is does not do well. New York is kind of down there with Texas on voter access. And so, like, can you really say, like, Oregon is better than Texas and New York? And it's harder to draw a straight line there.
But I kind of like it. I mean, I kind of like it that, you know, if I like anything where Oregon is great in both New York and Texas.
That's true.
Because then I'm not like anti-rural or like bad on cowboys, right. You know, but just like, no, like both of the, like I can like be mad at Pace Bacardi sauce and at whatever else. It doesn't matter.
Definitely Oregon wins on this one.
Let's go to then on voter access on Georgia. Georgia what? Enacts automatic voter registration in 2016. Big increase in voter registration rates, as high as 93%. 12,000 new voters added to the roll each week. 40% of Georgia voters are people of color. 47% of new Georgia voters are people of color. I will say, maybe this is just trying to recruit people to my political party. That sounds really important. Is that, but now a backlash? What's the state of voter access? Not just the attacks on it, which are getting some coverage, but the good news, places, not just Oregon, but other places that are trying to advance doing things like automatic voter registration.
Yes. I mean, automatic voter registration is a great example. Oregon was the first. We were the very first state to do automatic voter registration. And now there are 19 other places that are doing it. And hopefully, eventually, every state will do it. And it seems to me like such a no-brainer, right? You have people who are eligible citizens. They are showing up at a government agency with an ID, proving their identity, proving they're a citizen. Just put them on the voter rolls. And so a lot of other states are seeing the sense in that too.
Third on your Infinity Stones in ranking. We went out of order that you listed them, but I like this order better.
Yeah, this is so hard because...
Because somebody gets to be last.
Yeah. And it's also hard because like sortition, I think has this huge potential. Yeah. Like maybe the most potential of any of these.
That's the one that is becoming my number one.
Yes.
Deservant of energy, which is where I want to finish.
But it's the least proven. And so whereas like proportional representation, I can kind of point to the countries that have done it and said, you know what? They've taken bolder climate action.
Germany's always been great. Every time Germany has done it, it's been so great.
Right. They have less inequality. They've legalized gay marriage much faster. You can see the results that it has. Whereas sortition, like, I think it would be cool, but do I really know?
The mad scientist inside Kristen Eberhardt thinks he's right. Yeah. That's how I am.
So I'm like, maybe sortition is my first, or maybe it's the last. I actually don't know how much it can really do.
That's fair. So let's dwell on it for a moment. The reason it approaches first, or, you know, like where more and more of my energy is going, or more of my attention is going, and maybe it's just out of curiosity, but one of the same reasons you like, the same reason as one of the reasons you like proportional representation is that it seems to offer some hope of breaking down. I'm bored of the word partisanship in part because it falsely suggests a sort of symmetrical divide, which it's very asymmetrical, but let's call it tribalism. Right. That if you bring people together, like when I'm in a randomly selected jury, and by the way, sortition, if that's a weird new word to folks, what we're basically talking about is citizen juries. We're basically talking about a jury selected ancient Greece style, but not as racist and sexist as ancient Greece style, randomly selected people, but hopefully truly representative making decisions. Is that, how would you describe it? How badly or well did I do?
Yeah, I describe it as a curated jury selection, you know, so anybody who's ever been to a jury, you're like, I don't know, is this really a jury of your peers? So the
citizen, are these my peers? Yeah, yes, they are. You're freaking peers.
So the citizen jury selection, actually, it's a group of regular people, but they are selected to represent the diversity of the bigger group that they are representing. So in Oregon, you would say, you know, we're geographically, in terms of age, in terms of gender, in terms of race, in terms of education, this group is going to look like all of Oregon.
And then you give them information. So it's different than just direct democracy where you say, hey, everybody, let's take a poll. Whatever the poll says goes. But you give them some, you allow them still to deliberate. It's still a deliberative body of some sort. Any examples of citizen juries or curated juries or sortition that you're looking at? Anybody who's trying an interesting pilot? Because I got something to plug to you.
Oh, okay, good. So most of the pilots are, they're kind of interesting. You know, people get together, they come up with some policy recommendations, and then nothing happens. So the most interesting thing that I think is happening right now is Belgium has a continuous citizen jury. So it's not just like, hey, tell us what to do on climate change and then we'll ignore you and you'll go away. It's actually a sitting body that's now a part of their government. And has some lawmaking power, and people rotate through it, I think, like every 6 months, which means that it's like by in the next 10 years, like most Belgians will have served on it at some point. And it has more power than just like writing a report.
The plug I have is right now, I mean, like locally, it seems like the same move that you want to do with school boards and portion representation could happen with city charter reviews, when cities and counties are reviewing their charters, that inserting within local governments some element of not just advisory group, hey, we're gonna, write reports about how the police are doing, and or racial impact statements or environmental impact statements, but go deeper and say, no, we are certain decisions, and here's one way to maybe do it, is you create a citizen body. It is selected to represent the citizenry, and the currently elected city council and or the mayor, depending, could refer questions to it. Right. So you could like say, okay, yeah, we make an answer to city council. And right now, sometimes they'll refer to the voters, right? The voters get to decide. You don't have to take that option away, but you give one, it's sort of a baby way of doing sortition. Sort of saying, okay, this is the kind of question. And then we figure out over time the kind of questions that work best for that. Anyway, there's my plug.
I have another plug. In, Oregon, where we had senators leave the state to deny a quorum.
That could never happen. Why would they do that? They would be not doing their job, and it would seem horrible, right? I would,
And then voters would punish them for it,
yeah,
right?
they
For
would lose
not
their
doing their
election. And
job.
you'd have to have consensus among the press that that wasn't a good thing. I mean,
So having a safety mechanism that says, look, if an issue comes up and people are ready to vote on it, but they're denied a quorum, we kick that issue to a citizen assembly and give them authority to implement, to make into law whatever they come up with on that topic. So now there's, some motivation to stay in the room, and something happens if even if they don't stay in the room. And I, sorry, I have to go.
Yeah, we've got to wrap this. And I do want to push back on one thing that I said, which is sort of the mechanism of ranking. I mean, they started doing that with college football teams just because it gave them an order to talk about them. The ranking doesn't matter because it in most respects, because you might be all of the above. Also, it probably matters which thing where for what purpose, right? And so I want to push
And
back on
also a
that
lot of these
clumsy
think
way of
they're
thinking about
really
it.
synergistic, right? Like if you have a proportional system, but not everybody gets to vote, then it's not going to proportionally represent them. And similarly, if everybody gets to vote, but their vote doesn't matter because of the Electoral College, then it, doesn't matter as much that they'll vote. So in a lot of ways, you just need them all together.
Kristen Eberhard, final word.
Check out my book. It's on audio, Kindle. Print book, becomingademocracy.com.
Becoming a Democracy, How We Can Fix the Electoral College, Gerrymandering, she says gerrymandering, so that should probably govern, and Our Elections by Kristen Eberhard. Thank you, the author, Kristen Eberhard, for joining. Congratulations on getting the book done.
Thank you so much.
It's great to see
Okay.
you.
All right. Bye.